Joining us today on Medical Monday to discuss mental health and substance abuse issues is Dr. Jennifer Michaels, Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been in practice for over 15 years. Dr. Michaels, welcome back, Jen, to the Medical Monday.
Thank you for having me back, Alan.
Well, we love having you here. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wmc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WMC Vox Pop. But most of all, and this is what you probably ought to do, you can always email us at the good old-fashioned way at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. Jen, we've had this spate of killings around the country. We've had the Boston thing just yesterday where my son is in. He was a block away in New Orleans when 18 people were shot, but not killed, thank God. And so I'm sort of wondering, are we paying, as a nation, a psychological price because this stuff is about us even when we're not cognizant of it?
Alan, I think we are. And we're becoming the collateral damage of these events. You know, the people who are in the war zone are really damaged, but we're damaged when we watch TV excessively. We talk about it. It's on our minds. We're waiting to get the next tidbit. And my patients are anxious. They're fearful. You know, it's kind of changed the climate of our society.
What about our children?
And yes, our children are very vulnerable and they take their cues from us. So if I go home and sit in front of the TV for 5 hours waiting to find out more about the kidnapping, my kids will you know, watch me and feel a similar kind of anxiety. So it's important for us to resume activities and then check in with the news periodically.
And not become obsessive about it.
Yeah. And you know, for example, we know that if you watch the news just before you go to bed, you will dream about the events.
Huh.
So don't do that unless you want to have nightmares.
Yeah.
You know, our brain is wired for negativity. And that doesn't sound very optimistic, but there's a reason for that. You know, we need to survive. And so negative events have much more potency in our brains, in our primitive part of our brains. And we hold on to that.
Do we find other addictions, Dr. Michaels, do we find other addictions get worse at times of national stress?
Yes, that's a really good point. What we see is that if people are stressed out and overwhelmed, they may start drinking to cope with the stress. You know, some of our healthier mechanisms, going for a jog, talking to someone, they may erode, and a quick fix, quote unquote, quick fix will, you know, take hold. And people may relapse after a sober period or binge eat even because they can't handle the stress. There's a pattern of just being on overload and needing a way out.
Yeah, you know, there are always those famous stories, whether they're true or not, of Pompeii, you know, and people sort of resorting to thoughtless sexual process as the terrible events unfold and the volcano lets off its lava. So there is that. Let's go to Stephen in New York City. Okay, all right, and here we go to Stephen. All right, Stephen. Okay, Stephen, you're on.
Thank you. Hello, Dr. Michaels.
Hello, Stephen.
I have worked in the New York City school system, now called the Department of Education, for well over 30 years. I worked there as a teacher, I worked there as a counselor, and I also worked there as an interim administrator at a certain point for a guidance program. I do not know if you're aware of the sexual abuses happening to students by teachers, because I've worked in at least four high schools where teachers were having sex with students. And I mentioned this to you on the air because when I called up the United Federation of Teachers president, Michael Milgrew, when I spoke to the head of the guidance counselors, when I tried to speak to other people at the UFT, and I called them, I spoke to the secretaries of the president of the UFT, telling the secretary, they give you maybe a minute on the phone. I spoke to three secretaries on three separate times for about 15 minutes explaining what I'm saying to you now.
Okay, Stephen.
But my point is this. Yeah. No one returned my call from the UFT. I have contacted the Board of Education and their Special Inspector General's office, and nobody wants to
Stephen, I'm going to have to interrupt. Is there a question for Dr. Michaels here?
Yes. I can pose a question. Dr. Michaels?
Yes.
My question is, you realize the trauma of sexual abuse that happens to young girls and possibly some boys. I'm not that familiar with the boys' area. What can be done so that the union and the Board of Education have a program so that when teachers in schools are having sex with students outside school...
Okay, it's come around for the second time now, okay. Stephen. We got the question.
I'll do my best to answer this. Yeah. You know, these problems do exist. Fortunately, they're not pervasive, but they certainly do exist. And there are agencies in Massachusetts, Department of Children and Families. I am a mandated reporter. My understanding is that teachers are also mandated reporters.
Now, what does mandated reporter mean? You have to tell.
If I suspect that there is abuse or neglect, if I see signs of that, I must report this. The specifics of it, the person, the perpetrator, the victim, to this agency, and they will then investigate. So I'm mandated to report. Physicians are.
And you think teachers are,
too? I think teachers are, too, and other people in the community in those positions.
Okay, so Stephen, it's a political question, and we're dealing with mental health questions today.
Hello, can I say something, please?
Yeah, but it's got to be contained, please.
Be very terse. The principals in many of these schools, for political reasons, refuse to report it, and they tell the teacher or the guidance counselor, I'll handle it, and they don't report it.
Okay.
And if you do report it over their head, they have ways of being very punitive, and I'm offering this to you because I'm telling you, this doesn't happen just a few dozen times.
Stephen, you're coming around for the third or fourth or fifth time. We appreciate that. But again, I think your concern is important, but that's not what Dr. Michaels is here for today. Thanks a lot. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you call right now, your chances of getting in are 100%. And at the end of this program, every phone will be ringing like crazy. I have a question for you, Dr. Michaels, and that is, we keep hearing that the problem is really not guns in the great gun debate. The problem is really mental health. I say it's the problem of mental health and guns. I mean, in other words, some mentally unhealthy people get guns, and I think we have to do more for the mentally ill. That's clear. What do you make of this?
Alan, there's so much to say about this topic. Number one, the problem with guns and mental health. If you look at the people who are killed by guns in this country, what percentage of those people do you think are killed by suicide? What would you say?
I have no idea.
It's almost two-thirds.
Really?
So I think our country has a fear of guns and murder, but people who have mental illness, depression, hopelessness, are killing themselves with these guns. So if you have a gun, that gun is more likely to kill someone in a suicide attempt than to murder someone.
Which is interesting because we just saw this very interesting set of stats that came out and said that that middle class, middle range, middle aged people were killing themselves in greater numbers than ever before. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that we have a lot of stressors. People are not living the life that they would like necessarily. They have losses. They can't pay their mortgages. As people age, they're more likely to become hopeless and suicidal. You know, it's interesting, Alan. We have a wonderful array of antidepressants, and they've been developed since the 1960s. And we can give these to people who have depression. And yet, suicide rates have not diminished.
No.
So we're missing something. One thing I know is that access to a gun or a quick way to kill yourself is the risk is the riskiest component of a suicide attempt.
To wit, fewer guns, there would be fewer immediate people, I hate to use this term, gratifying themselves by killing themselves.
Yeah, and you know, also, Alan, people who are suicidal are not mostly suicidal for months or weeks. People who commit suicide or attempt suicide and fail at suicide, we're able to interview them afterwards, will report that they've been thinking about suicide for an hour or 4 hours or 8 hours. The vast majority of people who make suicide attempts have a brief window of distress.
Which is why when the doctor, you go into the doctor's office and there's always this question on the intake form, have you ever considered suicide? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's the point.
Okay. Yes.
Jennifer Michaels, we're delighted to have you here. All five phones are ringing as I knew they would. And we'll be right back. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back. And we are back with our friend, Dr. Jennifer Michaels. All five phones are ringing right now. Wait till somebody hangs up and then call 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Annabelle in Saugerties. Annabelle, you're on.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Michaels pertaining to an event that happened to me. Dr. Michaels, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. I'm listening, Annabelle.
Okay. I and my husband, with our two children, were living together, and abuse was escalating, verbal, physical, not raising hands, but blocking each other, slamming doors. It was getting really bad. And I called the police because I couldn't take it anymore, and the kids were, were really scared. We've since resolved that situation. However, I called the police, and obviously it was a domestic dispute, but I was taking antidepressants at the time. I had, like, PMD and, like, anorexia bulimia syndrome.
Okay.
So I was taking, like, Wellbutrin, sort of like the New York cocktail of Wellbutrin, low dose of Klonopin, and Lunesta for sleep.
Okay.
So the police arrived, and my husband said, look, she's on medication. They removed me from the house, brought me to the hospital. I received a diagnosis, the next day. It was wrong. It happened twice. Where I saw a doctor or got hospitalized, was diagnosed as bipolar or PTSD with. Anyway, what is the percentage of how many times people are misdiagnosed under the duress of a, an instant hospitalization and kept and mismedicated?
Annabelle, you bring up some very good points. First of all, I'm so glad that you were getting help for your initial diagnoses, the premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And for people not aware of that diagnosis, that means before a woman has her menses, she feels irritable, depressed, and less functional, and antidepressants can help. And it sounds like you were recovering from your eating disorder and doing well. You're very correct that when people are experiencing extreme stress, they may look very aggressive, they can look manic, they can become suicidal. So it's an acute crisis situation. We cannot accurately diagnose someone during that time. So in your case, I would recommend that you see someone now that the crisis has abated and get a full evaluation, and then that initial diagnosis can be called into question.
Have you heard of ACT, assertive community treatment? Because finally I'm getting decent treatment, and it's a new model that most people haven't heard of, right?
Yes, it is new. I know a little bit about it because I recently presented to a group and learned about it through my research for the presentation. But maybe you can say what it has done for you.
What it has done for me has created a dialogue with a group of people, including a doctor, a nurse, some peer counselors, the coordinator, and who else is on the team? Two, like, sort of interns or just new people at social work. And so it's a group of nine. And after a hospitalization, I qualified for this. And what they did was they came to my house and there was a medication regimen to start with post-hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought the medication and, you know, step one was like taking it, taking it correctly. And then we could tweak it to address certain symptoms. But everything was done in the home. So there wasn't the alienation of the office, the crazy, you know, fees of putting the medicine piece together with the talk piece and finding compatible relationships with providers.
And I think the goal, too, is to see you in your natural environment so a more accurate diagnosis can be made. It also fosters you being in control, you know, being part of your treatment team rather than having it imposed on you. So, you know, I'm hopeful for you that if you continue on this path, you'll get the right diagnosis and we'll get the right medication and the right therapy. But it does take time. I wouldn't want to make a diagnosis with one visit. And it's hard to make an accurate diagnosis. I agree
with
you.
I hear what you're saying, totally.
And yeah. Annabelle, I've got to let you go, and I thank you for having the courage to call and to discuss this. Very important. Thank you, because
you're
other
welcome.
People
Thanks.
Are doing this too. Thanks. Let's go to Jacob in Pittsfield, 1-800-348-2551. Jacob.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Jennifer. How are you doing?
Hi.
So I didn't have a very specific question, but it's something that I've talked about with a number of people and was just hoping maybe you could provide some information to the community, specifically about veterans, returning combat veterans, to the Berkshires or in New York or the general area, about what are some services that are available to veterans out there, maybe free services or those, because it's very difficult for returning combat veterans to get those types of services, backups at the VA, very limited therapy, and a lot of the treatments that are for PTSD and whatnot are very medication heavy and not necessarily related to therapy or group therapy. And I was just hoping you could maybe talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I'm sad to hear that it's not a more robust treatment. And I would advocate for that very strongly because the group of people you're describing really need therapy and therapy works. So I would start with the VA and self-advocate for treatment. And then also know that if you're not getting the help you need, you can go to community mental health. So, for example, Berkshire Medical Center, the Breen Center, two places where I'm working, we see plenty of vets and we encourage them to be part of our programs. We have a vet who has been in our addiction treatment program. He's sober, he's reunited with his family, he's doing well. So start with the VA and then branch out. That would be my suggestion. Community mental health treats everyone.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you,
and
Jacob.
And best of luck.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Bill in Albany. Bill, you're on.
Yes, good day, Alan. Good day, Doctor. I'm sure you've heard the saying, opposites attract. Well, that's true, but it sometimes can lead to problems. I'm a obsessive compulsive, cleanliness, organized, well-organized person. My background is quartermaster in the service and school librarian. So when in doubt, I throw it out. My wife is a pack rat. And sometimes when it's time to, like, weed and get rid of things, it can lead to arguments in our household. We're both good people, but, again, we're opposites. And I'm in the living room, and she's cooking and listening in the kitchen. So we'd like to hear which one of us is crazy.
Bill, how long have you been married?
10 years.
So there has to be a lot of love in this marriage because you are really different people and you're together. So I don't think either one of you is crazy. I think you have a way of engaging the world that is very different, and they are polar opposites. And it would be useful for you to see a therapist, your wife to see a therapist, and to work on your different styles and see if there's a way to overlap, ultimately maybe meeting together and compromising. It would be good for everyone involved.
Seeing a therapist together or individually?
Maybe start individually because it would be useful for you to look at your obsessive compulsive tendencies and your wife to talk about her rat pack problem and start to take responsibility and then move towards couples work.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go in there and pick up the kitchen right now.
Okay.
Thank you, Bill. 1-800-348-2551, which brings us to Paul from Pittsfield. Paul.
Hello, Dr. Michaels. I was at the luncheon or breakfast you had last week in Southern Berkshire County for homeless. You're an amazing speaker,
Thank you.
I'm really glad that you joined us. My question is about mental illness in Berkshire County and mental illness in America and then maybe even internationally. How does the U.S., how does Berkshire County, how do we size up? Are we one of the most mentally ill countries in the world? And is that why we have things like what happened in Cleveland and what happened in Aurora and what happened in Newtown? And are we on par? And if we are, how do other countries respond? And is there a country that's sort of leading the way, or a county like Berkshire County that's leading the way and responding in an effective way and sort of destigmatizing mental illness and having a community respond supportively and collectively?
Oh, that's a lot of questions, Paul. Well, I first would say I don't think that we have cornered the market on mental illness. I think that we are diagnosing more mental illness in the community. I think that other cultures tend to ignore mental illness. So a very obvious depression in the United States may be diagnosed as a stomach ailment in China. So other cultures may diagnose a more somatic or body illness. We diagnose a mental illness. So I don't know if that helps you to understand. I know that another example, in more primitive cultures that do not have the access to mental health, someone with schizophrenia may be diagnosed as a shaman because he hears voices, and that's the norm for their culture, and that person is embraced, whereas here someone is diagnosed with a psychiatric illness and put on antipsychotics and has a very different experience. So is that helpful at all, Paul? There was one more part to your question, I think.
Yeah, it is helpful. I think I'm more concerned with, especially with what happened in Cleveland with the sexual molestations and the kidnapping and the raping, and it just seems so dramatically harmful on such a disturbing scale. And I asked myself, do other countries experience this scale of mental illness with a sort of degree of harm that we have? It seems like so typical in the United States that things like this happen. And I wonder about that. Are we more sick than other countries?
Okay.
And if we are, what are the solutions? What's the thing that makes us sick? What are the things that...
Why are we that way?
Okay. Dr. Michaels, I only want to tell you, we have five people on the line.
Okay, very quickly.
Yeah.
It can feel like this is typical, but part of why we're so shocked and watching it compulsively is it is so atypical. And please know that these are very rare but universal events that happen around the world. Fortunately,
sure.
You know, torture, kidnapping, these kinds of events are extremely rare. We're not unique, but when we hear about it, we are traumatized and we are compelled to watch.
Yeah.
So I hope that's some reassurance. Obviously, we need to look more at this, but we do not have an epidemic of Cleveland episodes in our country.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Yeah. 1-800-348-2551. One free phone. Let's go to Alex in South Hadley. Alex?
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi.
Thank you very much for the intellectual debate thus far. I agree with some of the points that have been made, but I'm curious. I personally have went to a lot of talk therapy and just psychologists when I was young, and it did help significantly, and I personally am very interested in psychiatry, especially medicated psychiatry, which is kind of a big thing in a big industry these days. But I'm concerned that sometimes it leads the debate away from possibly some of the social root causes of depression when you call it an illness and then say, okay, let's try to correct the symptoms this person is sad. But the general malaise that I think can occur from disharmony in an entire nation about things maybe we're not talking about politically that I won't get into. But I'm concerned, I guess, what's your opinion on, do you think this leads the debate away from maybe talking about, huge social things that are going on in all of us that maybe we're not discussing that are causing the depression and the general malaise or the increased level of suicide where, you said the weapon is the most volatile part of a suicide or the immediate ability to take one's own life is one of the most dangerous parts. But I really think if, you know, it's very easy for somebody to drive a car into, you know, off the highway. I mean, you could do other things very quickly. And I know this is long-winded, but I guess I'm just curious if you think the debate should just be about more about, wait, why are we all experiencing this depression, as opposed to should we medicate it, or let's tweak it and let's try to cure these people of their illness.
Hmm. So, you know, it may have been confusing. We are not all depressed. Most people.
Oh no, yeah, I didn't mean that. I meant it seems like a lot of people discuss depression as something that is generally increasing in American society, mm-hmm. or it's something that, you know, that is, or at least this debate. Let's say mental illness is something
Alex,
that people...
Alex?
Yes?
I wonder if we could just let Dr. Michaels answer the question. Go ahead.
You know, I think there are a few forces at work here. First of all, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, depression was a dirty word. People didn't talk about being in a depression. You know, if one political candidate had ECT and it mm-hmm. destroyed his career because he got treated for depression.
That's Eagleton.
Yes. I mean, if you had a mental illness decades ago, your
sure.
life was over
sure.
Or your future was over. And I think it's taken decades to destigmatize. There still is stigma. More people are talking about depression, and it's becoming more acceptable to get help, get treatment, get medication. So I think that's the biggest issue, that it just like breast cancer 30 or 40 years ago,
sure.
people didn't talk about it. They were ashamed that a female body part had, you know, a malignancy. And so people did not enter treatment until it was practically terminal. The parallel is with major depression or other mental illness. Let's destigmatize, let's get treatment earlier, and let's help people to live better lives.
Alex, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Joe in Utica. That leaves two free phones, lines 4 and 5. Not that it matters to you, but which line they are, but 1-800-348-2551. Joe in Utica, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. My question is the effect of how the media reports, you know, when a mass shootings take place, they give attention to the shooter and thereby creating copycats. You know, these other people that are seeing this want the attention and thereby, in a sense, making it happen again. And I almost feel like that when this happens, they should show absolutely nothing about the perpetrator. Only the victims. So these people that are watching this that may have a problem, you know, don't get ideas. Has there been any studies done on this, and what's your opinion?
Well, I'll tell you my opinion. I think the media is doing a better job of de-emphasizing the aggressor and focusing on the victims. I think that has happened over time. There is that risk of a copycat, you know, or someone who wants the attention and you know, the front page in the paper. But fortunately, we haven't seen a lot of that. There is always that concern. But media is doing a good job of de-emphasizing the aggressor.
You know, but to Joe's point, interesting, Dr. Michaels, today we had the shooting in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some speculation that these guys saw the Boston thing happen, mm-hmm. and therefore replicated it or tried to replicate it. We don't really know anything yet,
mm-hmm.
but that was one thing. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That's true. That could be connected in some way. Yes.
Joe, you were going to say?
Yes. The Newtown shooter was reported to have read about and watched the perpetrator in, I believe it was in Norway.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Who killed
all children.
Those students
yeah.
on the island. He wanted to have more victims than he did.
Yeah, and I think that was part of his pathology. I don't know if it doesn't seem that his watching led him to do that. I think he's wanting.
But it gave him the idea of, hey, I want to outdo that guy.
Well,
I
mean, how would you stop that?
Yeah, that's the problem.
Well,
the problem would be is don't report. Just report something happened, and that's it. I know that may be extreme. It's a free society.
Well, you know, there's some precedent for that in terms of the way in which we treat bomb threats. You know, in the old days, there was a bomb threat. Everybody knew about it. I think there are places which really don't report bomb threats for exactly that reason. Of course, there is still a lot to do. Hey, Joe, very provocative question. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Okay.
We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back. We are back, and thanks to Zach the engineer for pointing that out. I was lost in thought over some of the excellent questions which you've all been asking today. With us is Dr. Jennifer Michaels. We're delighted to have her here. Let's go to Leanne in Hyde Park. Hi, Leanne.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to take it off. Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, go ahead.
I have a 11-year-old who threatened suicide, and I've been bringing him to a psychologist. They never asked for a fam. Like they said, oh well. I said after. Said, well, doesn't the family get involved? Don't you check family interactions and get into that? And they said, oh yeah, your husband should come or something. But they never met his older sister. They've never really done anything. I don't really know where to go to get competent help for him.
So I'm in your camp. I think that not only should your child be evaluated, but parents, siblings, and then the family dynamics. And there are some programs that will actually go to your house and evaluate you there, which I think is just wonderful. I do not know of programs in your location. I know in the Breen Center, Community Mental Health in Berkshire County, we will go to your home and do a full evaluation for the entire family so that we get an accurate understanding of what the child is going through. So
I mean, I was going to bring him to a center one time, like mm-hmm. to get, you know, like, and they said, oh, well, but he's not acute. You know, he wasn't in an acute phase or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. his episodes are very short, like things won't go his way or he'll really want something and he'll go get a knife and hold it against his chest.
But that's, you know, that's very extreme and upsetting. And I would recommend you talk to the pediatrician who can make another referral. Look for community mental health in your community. And there should also be a crisis team that you can call if these episodes recur. But don't give up. And I agree with you that they should be evaluated. It sounds like your child could benefit from alternative behaviors when he's really upset. What else can he do?
Right.
You know,
I mean, he's on two medications now also. He just started like 2 milligrams of Abilify, and he's also on Sertraline or something for.
Okay.
Yes, you know.
And so, you know, that the person prescribing those medications obviously needs to know about his behaviors.
That's a nurse. Yeah, she does. That's a nurse psychiatric practitioner,
okay.
But she doesn't do behavior. She's not the behavior part of it.
Okay, but sometimes a behavioral therapist can help young people learn alternative, more healthy behaviors.
Okay.
And I would just do everything to get that in place.
Okay, thank you.
Leanne,
thanks
for sharing. Appreciate it.
All right.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551. Brendan in Poughkeepsie. Okay, Brendan.
Yeah, hey, Dr. Michaels.
Hi.
I'm currently 5 months sober from addiction to heroin and other drugs. And my question for you is, I've been dealing with a lot of heavy depression mm-hmm. on and off, and I'm afraid to try any antidepressive drugs. Is it just post-acute withdrawal syndrome? Should I just hold on and keep staying sober?
Okay, Brendan.
And like in a year, I'll feel better?
Well, okay, Brendan's bringing up a lot of good issues. First of all, congratulations on your sobriety. That is not easy to do. So congratulations.
Yeah,
good work. And what Brendan's talking about is post-acute withdrawal syndrome. So what we're familiar with is acute withdrawal. You stop a substance you're using, and for the next week or so, you feel awful, but then it goes away. After that week, though, you will have post-acute withdrawal, and the symptoms are more nebulous. It may be insomnia, sadness, poor concentration, lack of motivation, and these are the same symptoms that we see with depression. So if you are suffering from depressive symptoms and you have a history of depression or family history of depression, or it's a severe depression, I would suggest you get on medication because it will not just get better on its own. And untreated depression increases your risk of relapse on substances. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so, and get evaluated. Go to a psychiatrist who understands co-occurring disorders, depression, and substance use, and consider a trial.
Okay.
Okay, and
awesome.
I wish you the best.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Much.
Okay, so now we have three free phones, believe it or not, and 1-800-348-2551. You want to get in, now's the time to do it. Let's go to Andy in Schenectady. Andy.
Hi, Helen.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Michaels. I'm legally blind, and I'm schizoaffective. I've been sick since 1986, and the original diagnosis was major depression with psychotic features. And what I've learned over the years is that I have anxiety and panic attacks, and especially when I'm out in public. And if I have a safe person with me, I still feel anxious and anxiety. And what my question to you is it because of my eyesight or is it because of my mental illness?
Andy, that's a complicated question because both can bring on anxiety, social anxiety, and they can also interact in such a way that the symptoms are magnified. So either way, there is a manner to help you to feel better. I don't know if you've ever completed a cognitive behavioral therapy program, but that is a wonderful way to work on anxiety symptoms and lower them. So it really focuses on the intensity of your anxiety. So you may start out at an 8, and the goal of cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT brings them down to a 2 or 3.
Well, what is that, Dr. Michaels?
It's a number of things. It's looking at your triggers that cause anxiety and then kind of doing an intervention on your anxiety and how irrational are your thoughts? What's a rational intervention? Learning skills to turn down the dial on your anxiety. Mm. And we do this for phobias, people afraid of heights or snakes. We can help them with that.
Cats. I knew somebody with cats.
Cats, you name it. We can do it. CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy is wonderful because you don't have to talk about what happened when you're 3 or, you know, why you're angry with a parent. You talk about here and now symptoms and how to diffuse them.
Interesting. Andy,
okay.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate
it. Thank you for your help, Dr. Michael.
Thank you. Best of luck to you.
Ron in Great Barrington. Hi, Ron.
Oh, hi. You mentioned ECT earlier, and I wonder if you would speak to that a bit and tell me what diagnosis would you refer someone to that type of therapy? What's the success rate of ECT, which is electroconvulsive therapy, and what are the side effects and so forth?
Sure. You know, for many years, there was a stigma attached to getting electroconvulsive therapy because we saw some scary movies in which it was featured. But ECT therapy does...
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I guess, right?
Yes, exactly that one.
Yes.
But ECT is a very effective therapy, and it's mostly used to treat severe intractable depression. So someone has been on antidepressants, it hasn't worked. Maybe they're severely suicidal. We can't wait for the pills to work. So we start ECT. It also has been used to treat mania, and it can work very well. It usually involves 6 or 8 episodes of treatment, and the major side effect is headaches and memory impairment for the time of treatment.
Yeah.
So it's preserved for really the more severe cases.
Right.
It's not.
I know. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
You know, it's okay. You go ahead.
I know someone who's done more than 30 sessions. Is that by that time? Would you say this is just not working? Or?
30 is a large number. Sometimes what happens is someone will have 8 or 10 and gets better. And then a year or two later needs 8 or 10 more, and then it repeats once a year. Some people have maintenance doses. They'll have 1 a month, and that seems to prevent the depression. So I'm not sure of your friend's situation, but that's a larger number. Some people need lower numbers like that 8 or 10 that I mentioned.
Hey, Ron, I want to thank you. It's a very good question. Thanks again.
Thank you, Al. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to... Martha in Pittsfield. Okay, Martha, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Michaels. I'll start off by saying that I
was a, I had a menopause psychotic episode. And fortunately, I was with a psychiatrist who realized that I was out of estrogen. What concerns me is that for, I can only speak for women, but in puberty, postpartum, and for menopause, why is the first, for women who are in depression, the first line of defense is always a therapist? No one is looking at the endocrinology for women who kill their babies, and we know that without without estrogen, antipsychotic drugs aren't going to work. I just see that there is no discussion at all about letting women know that their depression might be simply due to a lack of estrogen. I don't know why this is.
Well, certainly when women have low estrogen, they can experience depression and anxiety and night sweats, many symptoms. I think that is part of the depression spectrum, but what we are seeing is the generalized depression that has more to do with serotonin and norepinephrine. So I don't think it would be fair to say that women who have depression need estrogen.
I think that women who have a predisposition and we don't know it, and they don't know it, can be helped, as I was, with estrogen replacement. I just am concerned that endocrinologists are not being availed to treat and to deal with patients who are suffering depression, especially women. But,
I think also you bring up the good point of the need to collaborate between specialties such as psychiatry and gynecology. And
right.
Certainly women can benefit from both, but their physicians need to be communicating.
Interesting point, okay. Martha. Thank you very much. Appreciate
you're
it.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's go to Mike in Saratoga. Mike, you're on. Mike. Oh, what did I do? I did something wrong. Is anybody on? Huh, it's not my day. Let's go to Mike in Saratoga. Mike?
Yeah, are you there, Alan?
Yeah, we're here.
I hear you now. Great. So my question is, first of all, the situation is my wife and I have a daughter who is hard to get along with, and conversations are a little rough, and usually the answers are a little rougher. So I'm wondering if family therapy would be of help, and how would we go about starting that conversation?
How old is your daughter, Mike?
35.
Okay, so she's not a child at home, so she's somewhat independent.
No, she lives at home.
Oh, okay. So, and is she willing to go to therapy, or is she refusing to go?
I've never brought it up, only because I know, I think when it does, it's going to be a tough conversation.
Okay. So one way to deal with this is for you and your wife to initiate therapy to help you to bolster your skills in dealing with your daughter. Probably, if she's 35, she lives at home, she's difficult. Certain styles of communication have been, bolstered over the years that are not going to serve you all and your mental health. So I would suggest that you and your wife strengthen your skills in therapy and then invite your daughter in.
And I've tried that conversation with my wife, who seems to think that's not going to work. So I'm thinking that perhaps I should have a conversation with a family therapist first.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then so if your wife is hesitant, you go first, invite her in, and then bring in your daughter.
Yeah, I think so. Because right now it's very difficult.
And these situations tend not to get better on their own. It often requires that kind of catalyst of an outsider, a therapist, who can guide you and support you, and it shifts, but it's work. It's different.
Well, I understand that, and thank you very much, because that's exactly what I was thinking.
Hey, Mike, good luck to you, Mike.
Thanks, Alan. Yeah, appreciate fine. That.
All right, let's go to Bill in Hinsdale. Okay, Bill, you're on.
It's Bill. Hey, Alan.
Yeah.
Dr. Michaels, it's about my nephew who got in trouble with pain pills, which actually led to some heroin use for a good number of months. He went to detox. He got clean. He was doing pretty well, but he's starting to use heroin again, and he's got some friends. He's starting to tell us now he wants to go on this Suboxone, because his friends have been on it. But what I'm finding out is his friends have been on it for years.
Mm-hmm.
They're functioning, they're he says it's going to help. Now he won't be losing money. His relationships will stay. He'll be able to work. But they're on it for years. Is Suboxone something you get off, or is it? I don't understand it.
That's a big debate, Bill. Let me tell you a little bit about this. First, what Bill described in his nephew, getting addicted to pain pills and then buying them off the street, most likely, not being able to afford them, moving on to heroin, which is the most potent and cheapest that it's ever been. So, you know, we have a ready supply and it's very affordable. So we see an epidemic of these young people. And then at some point they want to stop. And like your nephew, he tried to stop. But he couldn't stay stopped. He ended up relapsing. And so then a viable option is replacement therapy, and that's what Suboxone is. It's an opiate that addresses symptoms of craving and withdrawal.
How is it different from methadone?
So methadone is a pure activator of your brain opiate receptors. Mm-hmm. So the more you take, the more you get an effect, to the point that if you take too much methadone, you could overdose and die. You know, it's a very good medication, but it could also be bad. Suboxone has a ceiling effect. So if you take extra or try to, you know, get high with it, you can't do that because you can't activate the receptors anymore with it. But it will address symptoms of craving and withdrawal. Craving and withdrawal drive the addict to use heroin. If those symptoms are addressed, they should not be using heroin. Okay, so the idea of when do they get off of it, I'm asked this all the time. My response is the measure of treatment success is not whether you're on or off. It's whether you're living a rich, rewarding, challenging life. And so if your nephew is having a happy, hardworking, you know, successful life, who cares if he's on Suboxone or not?
We do.
You do.
Yeah.
Well, I don't, because chances of relapse, when a patient is tapered and not ready to taper, chances of relapse to heroin is over 90%. So that's something to consider, that it takes the brain a minimum of 2 years to heal after active addiction has been happening. So,
and they come down, the dose comes down on the Suboxone? Is
the
that
dose,
how it works?
Yeah, the dose can come down slowly. But what I'm saying is it takes your brain about 2 years of active healing to occur when you're drug-free. So people will be on Suboxone for a while and hopefully creating very rich, wonderful lives, rewarding lives.
And here's the really bad news. We're out of time.
Hey, Thank you, Dr.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Okay. I'm so sorry to John of Greene County, who we can't get to today, but maybe next time. My apologies to him. I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Michaels, the wonderful Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Greene Center, for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-4767 for appointments. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phones. Tom Jobe is our web assistant. Our producer is Patrick Donjus. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/VoxPop.